Time for Crime in the City, our profiles of crime novelists, people who make murder their business. In our final installment this summer, we go to West Africa. Ghana is the setting for author Kwai Korte's whodunits. The Ghanaian-American author has written three books featuring Detective Inspector Darko Dawson. When Korte and NPR's Ophabia Quist Arkton met up, they focused on the second in the series with Ghana's bustling capital as the backdrop.
I'm Kwai Korte, author of Children in the Street, and we are at Agbogbloshie, which is a notoriously known slum in Accra, Ghana's capital.
And it's in this teeming shantytown of Accra that the first murder victim in Kwai Korte's second mystery novel, Children of the Street, is found. On a bank, bang in the middle of the putrid, stinking, dark waters of the Agbogbloshie Canal.
From a crime fiction writer's standpoint, I do have a leaning towards particularly sad or poignant areas for a place to die. Besides the awful fate that you have come to as you've been either butchered to death or shot or what have you, that you should die in a place that is so filthy, it's almost as though you've been further humiliated.
Doggedly determined, Detective Inspector Darko Dawson takes charge of the investigation that turns out to be serial killings of street children. Dawson is a loving family man who also loves his poorly paid job. He passionately wants to solve murders, especially when they involve society's cast-offs.
One of the most famous and significant things that he said to his boss who had dismissed the murder of a prostitute, he said, "Well, you know, a bank executive or prostitute, dead is dead, sir." And he sometimes runs up against opposition from his senior staff, who wonder why he cares so much about a murdered person who certainly was not important to society.
For example, street boys.
Right, street boys who were being murdered one after the other in Children of the Street.
A day shy of his 17th birthday, Musa was a boy with the survival instincts of a grown man. Blood sprang from the stab wound in his back, but he did not die instantly. As his blood drained, Musa had a running vision like a video of his short life.
The book begins with this brief encounter with the character Musa, who hails from impoverished, dry, dusty northern Ghana. He moves south to the lush green capital city in search of work to send money home to his mother. But after pushing open-top carts around the streets, ferrying heaving loads, Musa's is the first murder in Children of the Street. The prologue tells us...
Penniless and lonely, Musa hadn't known a soul in Accra. He only wanted his life to get better. As Musa's eyelids fluttered closed, he must have wondered if this is what his father had meant. If you go to Accra, you will become nothing but a street child, and you will pay a terrible price.
Kwai Korte's murder mystery concentrates on old Accra, on the coastal curve of the Atlantic Ocean. Korte makes it a point to personally research his murder locations during trips to Ghana from the US, where he's a practicing physician.
That was why it was important for me to actually go through Agbogbloshie itself and see what it was like, you know, smells and all. And I don't make places up, at least not anymore, because there's plenty of locations in Ghana that you don't have to ever make up.
Born to an African-American mother and a Ghanaian father, Korte was raised in Accra before heading to medical school in the U.S. He says Accra is a high-energy, rules-meant-to-be-broken kind of place in some parts that is both entertaining and exhausting.
The sound, the smells, and the sights, sometimes so much that your brain gets tired, but it is a perfect location for murders of all kinds because in many ways, for example, at nighttime, the city becomes very quiet and deserted and certainly very dark. And in some ways, it's easy to get murdered in Accra and you might be ignored for a while. The police may not find you for a little while.
And it's in some of these dark spots that crimes occur, like this commercial district, which was noisy and hectic during our daytime tour, but grows quiet once the traders disappear. Deep into the night, always on their guard, street children lie down to sleep after a punishing day of work.
This is an area in which, during the night, you would hardly expect a beautiful glossy Mercedes-Benz to sail in and have any business. And it's one of the reasons it caught Darko Dawson's eye, along with his team of detectives.
Now, don't give anything away, but give us a hint.
Well, the Mercedes took the child to a very upscale area in Accra, and because the house belonged to one of the characters who was interviewed by Darko Dawson, it immediately threw suspicion on him.
But D.I. Dawson's innate sixth sense sometimes lets down the tall, good-looking police officer. That's when he can't resist secretly puffing on a spliff. Marijuana is Dawson's Achilles heel. He agonizes when he hauls in the wrong suspect and has to release the person. And it's then that his loving family steps in to calm Dawson down.
Well, his wife, Christine, is a smart, attractive woman who is a teacher. And she provides a lot of insight for him, although she is not a cop. She's a stabilizing force for him, since he can sometimes go off the rails, especially when he finds himself wrong. And when he goes into depression over these, it's sometimes Christine who gets him out of it. She's a quiet backbone.
In the end, Detective Inspector Darko Dawson and his sidekick, Philip Chikata, get their killer and go on to new challenges. Korte tells NPR that he'll feature more about Ghanaian customs, values, and language in the next crime novel, with D.I. Dawson investigating a dead body and the murky world of illegal gold mining.
With gold, it seems almost a crazy, craven rush for wealth from that famous glinting yellow metal. Yeah, it's a totally different world for him.
Kwe Korte's Gold of the Fathers is due out next spring. Ofe Biakwistakton, NPR News, Accra.
The Bone Clocks is David Mitchell's newest book. Perhaps his best known is The Cloud Atlas, published several years ago and made into a movie. And Mitchell's many fans have been eagerly waiting for this new one, hoping it would present the same kind of fascinating puzzles as The Cloud Atlas, a very complicated set of nested dolls or nested plots. Now the new book is out. Mr. Mitchell is talking about it. He joins us from Cork in Ireland. Welcome to our program and congratulations on the new book.
Oh, thank you very much, Linda. It's great to be here, so thanks for having me on your program.
I understand that you have done something different in this book. You've built it around one character, a girl named Holly Sykes, who's a teenager when we first meet her, and an elderly grandmother at the end of the book. First of all, could you tell us about Holly and why you made her your hero?
Well, yes. Holly is, as you say, she's a rebellious teenage punkette in 1994. And she's there either as the narrator or a minor character turning into a major character in each of the six novellas that the book is made up of. She's obviously a she. That was a challenge for me. This is the first time I've had a female protagonist who's sort of the glue of the narrative the whole way through. And the difficulties in doing that, as you can hear, as a guy, were attractive ones.
So this is a book, as you said, in six parts, six novellas, you called it. There's teenage Holly. Then there are three sections of Holly as seen by three men in her life. Yeah. And then we and Holly take a sudden dunk into a magical sci-fi world, followed by a nasty dip into a dystopian farish future. And the thing that was interesting to me, among other things, was that you don't prepare us for these adventures. You just turn the page and whoops-a-daisy, you're in another world, in another place, with another set of realities. I wonder if you could talk to us about why you did that.
Because that's what I like as a reader. I like being surprised. I like having the rug pulled from under my feet. The rules have to be fair, and I have to trust the writer that it's not being done gratuitously or just for the sake of it. I'm interested in genre. I think it's an underused set of colours in a writer's paint box. I think interesting things can happen if a book moves through these sort of rooms of genre, or these chambers.
Now, I suppose I get this next idea from the name that you've given Holly. She is Holly Sykes. And you're creating a cast of characters here that do remind me of Dickens, you know, Bill Sykes, his big hero in Oliver Twist. His books are character-driven. This one is character-driven. I almost feel as if you demonstrated your considerable talent at creating acrobatic plots in the previous books, and now you've turned to creating characters, which I must say you do wonderfully well.
Well, thank you very much for those quite enchanting compliments that you smuggled through in your question there, Linda. That's really kind of you to say. But of course, he's a master. Of course, I've read him. Of course, if you're going to write a large, complex, teeming kind of a novel, you're a fool to ignore him. I chose Sykes also just because, thanks to Dickens, it kind of smells slightly of the East End of London. It's also quite a spiky name, don't you think? Holly is already spiky, thanks to the plant, and Sykes, it's quite close to spikes. It's sibilant, it's got a Y and a K in it. Even if you look at the word, it's got a stick pointing down and a stick pointing up. I think about this endlessly in the middle of the night when I can't sleep. It did take a long time to find that name, but until you get just the right name for a character, they're not properly alive.
Now, I have to say that the last two sections of the book, I'm not so good on the sci-fi, cosmology, dystopian future stuff. There's a lot of politics in the very last part, you know, the global warming and so forth. But, I have to say that I'm kind of standing with one of the characters who suddenly observes. He suddenly asks, didn't you just cross the border into the land of the crazy people? And I must say, it did feel, you know, it did feel sort of sudden to me.
Yeah. Guilty as charged, really. But it's what the book wanted to be. I know I'm in charge of it. I'm not trying to shirk my responsibility here. But this book wanted many diverse things in it. It's a big commitment to write something. It takes 3 or 4 years. I have to be deeply in love with it to get through that amount of time and still want to show up at my desk in the morning. And with an easier, safer, more predictable book, I just can't get excited enough. I'm an innate maximalist. I wish I wasn't, because believe me, I go too far away from reality for my own good. But this is how it is. I just need to write these big things and to see if I can put these elements in them that apparently, like matter and antimatter, don't belong together within the same book jacket. But I want to try and see if I can engineer a way to make them fit.
Do you know where you go from here? I've read you've said something about an uber novel that might encompass a number of your books, written and unwritten.
Well, yeah. The uber novel is the novel that all of my novels make up. So where I go from here, I do know what the next 4 or 5 books are, which is kind of why I regret the fact they're so long and I only seem to be able to get one out every World Cup year. I do need to speed up, or I'll be into my mid-60s before I know it. And that's just to get to the end of the queue of books that are waiting to be written.
The new book, The Bone Clocks, is officially out next week. Mr. Mitchell, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Our series on men will wrap up next week, but in the meantime, we've asked a few writers to share a must-read on the subject of being an American male. Poet Saeed Jones has this suggestion of a book that means a lot to him.
Here's something I wish I'd known when I was still a limp-wristed little boy. Any guy who pulls off that classic red-blooded man act like it's easy is lying. He's lying to you, and maybe he's even lying to himself, because being a man is damn hard work. Building that kind of persona is a precarious business. Some men just stop trying. We settle into an easier, more breathable version of ourselves. More desperate men might resort to sexism or violence to show that we measure up. And then there's the writer T. Cooper. His latest book is called Real Man Adventures, and he opens it this way. I am a visible man. By all appearances, white, middle class, heterosexual, male. Cooper is a happily married guy with two young stepdaughters. He's also transgender. This isn't a paradox. And through the book, which is made up of essays, lists, diagrams, and interviews with family and friends, Cooper shows us what he's learned about manhood on the way to becoming himself. One chapter is a list of changes he and his wife have noticed since he started taking testosterone. "I am angry more frequently," he says, or, "it takes way less to make me blazing mad." "People defer to me more," and, "I say less to strangers." Later, Cooper interviews the mother of a transgender friend. He admits, "I'm asking you these questions because I'm too much of a wimp to ask my own parents, or maybe I'm not ready to hear their answers." Cooper grapples with the idea of being or becoming a real man. He's smart and vulnerable, and he gets to an essential truth that I think is comforting for all of us. Manhood is something we create, like a work of art. The stoicism, the toughness, the strength, each one is like a painter's brushstroke on a self-portrait. By acting them out, we're saying, "This is who I am, this is who I want you to see." But if we're going to be real men, Cooper seems to imply it's because we're real to ourselves. Writing this book was an accomplishment, but it involved risk and sacrifice. Cooper knows the possible consequences of exposing his family and his personal life. For all the acceptance of transgender people in America, there's still a lot of work to be done. But if anything, the truth about manhood begins here, with the honest questions answered and the self laid bare. I would have loved Cooper's book when I was still a boy, but I guess, since becoming a man is an ongoing process, his brilliant writing arrived right on time, all the same.
That's poet Saeed Jones recommending T. Cooper's Real Man Adventures. Jones also has a new book out this month. It's called Prelude to Bruise.
This is Fresh Air. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of Ben Lerner's new novel, 1004. His 2011 novel, Leaving the Atocha Station, was named a best book of the year by, among others, The New Yorker, The Wall Street Journal, and The Boston Globe. Here's Maureen's review.
I admired Ben Lerner's last novel a lot. In fact, I ended my review of Leaving the Atocha Station by saying that reading it was unlike any other novel reading experience I've had for a long time. I could say the very same thing about Lerner's brilliant new novel called 1004, which leads me to wonder, just how many singular reading experiences can one novelist serve up? And if every one of Lerner's novels is singular, doesn't that make them, in a way, repetitive? Those are the kind of flip philosophical ruminations that Lerner's writing encourages. He's self-conscious, funny, and smart. His riffs on everything from wisdom teeth extraction to the space shuttle Challenger disaster flash by your eyes with the urban fluidity of silverfish. Granted, as I did while reading Leaving the Atocha Station, I got a little exasperated here with Lerner. He indulges a smarty-pants tic of using hyperinflated language to describe the mundane, like when his anonymous narrator in 1004 announces that he's crying by telling us he's having a mild lacrimal event. Too much of that Mr. Spock dialect can be a turnoff. Fortunately, though, Lerner reins himself in as the novel progresses. 1004 is a mind-blowing book. To use Lerner's own description, it's a book that's written on the very edge of fiction. Now, if only I didn't have to try to explain what the book is about, because just like its title, the plot of 1004 is way out of the box. Nevertheless, here goes. Our unnamed narrator, who intersects with Ben Lerner himself, has gotten a huge advance to write his second novel on the strength of a story he's published in The New Yorker. When 1004 opens, our narrator and his agent are celebrating at an expensive restaurant in Manhattan. There, they ingest baby octopuses that have been literally massaged to death by the chef. Our narrator tells his agent that he plans to expand his story into a novel by projecting myself into several futures simultaneously, by working my way from irony to sincerity in the sinking city. That, of course, is also an overview of 1004 itself, the hyper-aware novel Lerner writes for us, bookended by two historic hurricanes that threaten New York City, Hurricane Irene and Hurricane Sandy. 1004 projects our narrator into several possible plot lines. For instance, he receives a diagnosis of a serious aortic heart valve problem, as he also consents to be the sperm donor for a close friend who yearns to have a baby, while he also leaves town for a writer's retreat in Texas. Lerner's dazzling writing connects and collapses all these storylines into one. Here, for instance, is a snippet where our narrator describes New York City girding for Hurricane Irene. Note how octopi and aortas swirl into the hurricane update in this passage. From a million media, most of them handheld, awareness of the storm seeped into the city, entering the architecture and inflecting traffic patterns. I mean, the city was becoming one organism, constituting itself in relation to a threat viewable from space, an aerial sea monster with a single centered eye around which tentacular rain bands swelled. There were myriad apps to track it, the same technology they'd utilized to measure the velocity of blood flow through my arteries. Bravo! Lerner obviously loves playing with language, stretching sentences out, folding them in on themselves, and making readers laugh out loud with the unexpected turns his paragraphs take. This is a more ambitious novel than Leaving the Atocha Station, in that Lerner, as his narrator tells his literary agent in that opening scene, does work his way from irony to sincerity in the sinking city. The final scene of this novel, where our narrator and his pregnant close friend walk through a blacked-out lower Manhattan as Hurricane Sandy bears down, is as beautiful and moving as any of the tributes to New York written by other famous literary walkers in the city, like Walt Whitman and Alfred Kazin, who are presiding presences here. 1004 is a strange and spectacular novel. Don't even worry about classifying it. Just let Lerner's language sweep you off your feet.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed 1004 by Ben Lerner. Maureen has a new book of her own about to be published called So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. I'm going to talk with her about it on our show next Monday. There's still time to read The Great Gatsby before the interview. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
A new book, out today, explores how fashion and style have impacted women's lives. Essays, conversations, pictures, and testimonials from more than 600 women make up the book, Women in Clothes. Jackie Lydon has been taking a look at clothing, narratives, and history in an occasional series called The Seams. She has this story.
It can be hard to talk about clothes in an intelligent way. The fashion critic Kennedy Fraser once wrote in The New Yorker that the act of donning a garment can seem almost furtive or trivial, something beneath debate or intellectual content. The editors of Women in Clothes would agree that it's a challenge. Novelist Heidi Julewitz is one of them.
You know, when you hear the word fashion, you just think fashion magazine. You think of a certain kind of much more superficial way of talking about what you put on your body.
She and her two collaborators decided to send out questionnaires to hundreds of women.
We wanted to ask people questions that might in some ways be the province of a fashion magazine, but we wanted to really free people from that fashion language.
Fashion magazine language can be both tired and patronizing. Must-have outfits, do's and don'ts, competitive notions like who wore it best. Together with Leanne Shapton and Sheila Hetty, the authors created a list of 50 far more intriguing clothing questions.
What is your cultural background and how has that influenced how you dress?
Do you think you have taste or style? Which one is more important?
How does money fit into all this?
Did your parents teach you things about clothing? Care for your clothing, dressing, or style.
Please describe your mind. Please describe your body. Please describe your emotions.
And another thing they wanted to know was how many women were not interested in clothing. And among the 1,000 or so responses they got?
5%.
5%.
It's so frustrating when people say, I'm not interested in clothing. You know, what they mean is I don't want to appear to care about clothes.
That was certainly true for Sheila Hetty, one of the editors of Women in Clothes. She's the author of the novel, How Should a Person Be? She said she'd never given any thought to clothes. She was a writer, had an interior life. Clothes were external. But that changed a couple years ago.
I woke up one day and I just thought, today's the day that I want to figure out how to dress. You know, I wanted to know what other women thought about as they got dressed, how they knew what to buy in a store, how they knew what they wanted to wear. I wanted to sort of figure out what my taste was.
The submissions in Women in Clothes are stories or fragments, a chorus of voices from around the world about clothing as intimacy, emotion, memory. One woman talks of emigrating as a child from Vietnam. Their first apartment came equipped with an industrial sewing machine, and the whole family labored together sewing clothes. Another is a week's diary of a woman's compulsive purchases. The famous appear here, Miranda July, Lena Dunham, Cindy Sherman, but the vast majority are not. One contributor is Gilda Haber of Silver Spring, Maryland. As an author and educator, she's written thousands of pages on clothing rules, going back as far as ancient Greece and Rome.
Nobody realizes that this is a law, that you have to be dressed to a certain extent. So we are forced to dress, actually. Otherwise, we break the law if anybody should run naked down the street.
Clothing restrictions were part and parcel of her childhood. As a Jewish girl growing up in East London during World War II, Haber fixated on clothing as it defined her. She was an only child, shipped off to a Christian orphanage by her mother. There, she had to wear red bloomers. She hated them, and it got worse.
By the time I was 16, my mother had me measured and put into a corset with whalebone and hooks and a tie-up at the side, and you could knock on me.
Haber also describes how she was dressed the day an editor for Life magazine in London invited her to tea. She wanted to wear her first beautiful post-war white dress, which showed off her figure, but instead her mother forced her to wear her detested school uniform.
Tea was a disaster. The young, handsome editor expected a glamorous teenager. I was so angry with my mother that I risked a slap in the face. Right then, I decided to leave home and come to America, which I did.
Mothers and daughters usually have a primal relationship over clothes. Milena Rose's mother helped her answer a survey about what clothes she likes. Milena's 5, the book's youngest contributor.
The dress has flowers and it has drawn lace. And it has leaves on the leggings, and the dress has tiny flowers and designs.
But to wear shorts and t-shirts, that would make her
a little bit sad.
In Women in Clothes, the often elitist language of fashion is stripped away, leaving behind a conversation, sometimes funny, sometimes painful. Editor Leanne Shapton wrote the memoir Swimming Studies, for which Shapton won the 2012 National Book Critics Circle Award. She says that some of the best entries here show plain honesty, like this one she reads from Anne Ireland.
Often I'll spot a woman crossing the road who is wearing just the narrow gray black pants I want, or sneakers that are just one color with no ugly stripes. Maybe I could get away with that Indian dress. Those Jesus sandals are just the ticket. I bet they're comfortable too. Then I crave it, a sort of low-level fever that won't lift until I've located the desired item and seen whether it works for me too.
Clothing is triumph. Clothing is connection. And as this book attests, it's about the life of the mind and heart. Sheila Hetty offers this memory from a contributor named Amy Turner.
My favorite piece of jewelry is a gold heart that I got in upstate New York. I never have distinct or clear feelings, but when I saw it and put it on, I knew unwaveringly that it was for me. At the time, I was with a friend I'd become close to over a year of writing emails, and in our first exchanges, I knew that she was for me, too. Now, when I put the necklace on, I think of her, and I think of what it feels like to know something clearly in my gut.
Clearly, from the gut. You find that one thing, that one dress, jacket, hat, that makes you a big, bold personality, even if you're a little mouse. That's not shallow. That's about transformation. For NPR News, I'm Jackie Leiden.